This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
This week, researchers were struggling 2 decades ago trying to find the receptor for lysophospholipin.
That was looking for a needle in a haystack, and quite difficult because we did not succeed in getting enough protein to microsequence it.
Coming up, who finally found the receptor and what's happened since? Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and you're listening to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. First up, in news, staff writer Andrea Garleski has been following a story about a University of New Hampshire professor who was banned after threatening a colleague. This week, UNH offered this professor, John Collins, a chance to return, but with a few conditions. The story is rather complex, and Andrea has joined me in the studio to talk about it some more. How you doing?
Hi, Carrie.
So give me a little background. What originally happened between these two people at UNH?
Well, back in June, Professor Collins, who's also the chair of the Biochemistry and Molecular Biology Department, was banned from the campus at the end of June for having an outburst in the department building. He had gotten a parking ticket and came inside and allegedly was yelling and screaming about a colleague of his in the department, Stacia Sauer, who allegedly had called the police on him for being parked in a loading zone. So he got a parking ticket. And according to police reports and other alleged testimony, he said some threatening things about her. And so she got a restraining order against him, and the university also banned him from campus and had been banned all summer until recently.
So then what finally happened? Why did the university decide to offer him a reinstatement?
Well, actually, they've been having hearings every so often since he got banned from campus. And on August 20th, the provost told him that they'd finished their investigation of the incident, and on Friday, a source contacted me from the University of New Hampshire and told me that the provost sent Collins a letter saying that in conclusion of the investigation, you can be reinstated, but you will lose your chairship of the department, and there are other conditions that he'll have to undergo, such as taking an anger management class, writing an apology letter to Dr. Sauer and the provost of the university, and having to keep a permanent record in his file.
And you spoke with Collins. What did he say? Did he want to accept those conditions?
Collins is very upset about the offer the university has given him. He feels that the incident was very misrepresented, both in the investigation and in the media at the time. His version of the story says that the yelling that he did was mocking another woman who was sort of egging him on in the building after he'd gotten the parking ticket. It's very complicated. But he was very upset about the offer the university gave him, and they had a meeting in August, and he said that if the university wasn't willing to apologize to him and pay for all his legal fees and reinstate him as the chair in the department, he was going to file a case in federal court for an injunction against the university and also provide a huge stack of affidavits from the other faculty members of the department and in other departments in the university who had incidents with this Stacia Sauer.
And what about her? Did you speak with her about it?
I did not speak with, well, I did speak with her, but she declined comment.
Mm. Well, I guess what's happening with his science at this point? Is it just on hold?
The research in the lab has been a complete halt since June. His graduate researchers have been disbanded, and he had one postdoc who's now at a different university. They were supposed to publish a paper together, and the manuscript is still sitting in his office untouched. Collins is not allowed to go on the campus without a police escort, so he said that it would be very difficult for him to do any research with the police looking over his shoulder.
Wow. Well, I look forward to reading how you follow up and see how it resolves.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you. That was the scientist Andrea Garleski paying me a visit to talk about recent developments in a professor banned from the University of New Hampshire. You can read her coverage online at thescientist.com. Next up, how the lysophospholipid got its receptor. In the September issue of The Scientist, Gerald Chun, a professor at Scripps Research Institute, tells his story of how he found the lipid ligand that triggered a receptor he was studying. This lysophospholipid receptor turned out to be the one that Wouter Molinar at the Netherlands Cancer Institute and other lipidologists had been studying for years. Here, Molinar tells the scientist Adita Zielinska how he got started on the hunt for this receptor and where he's taken lipid research since Chun's discovery.
We got into this field because of our interest of phospholipids probably acting as calcium ionophores. That was in the mid-80s, because then there was the question of how receptor stimulation could activate calcium influx, and one of the hypotheses was that it could be phosphatidic acid, actually. And we studied that a lot, but we also discovered that it probably couldn't be phosphatidic acid doing the job, but that was an other phospholipid in our lipid preparation, probably in contamination, and as it turned out several years later, this contamination was actually lysophosphatidic acid. But that's how we stumbled into this field, so to speak, and that where we discovered that LPA has hormone-like and growth factor-like properties, very likely acting through G-protein-coupled receptors. That was in the late 80s, actually. And then we continued the story with unraveling the downstream signaling events, identifying a putative receptor biochemically, but we were unable to clone the receptor. And it was many years later, indeed, in 1996, that Gerald Chun, coming from an entirely different angle, a different field, that he discovered a so-called orphan receptor that happens to respond to LPA. And that is how both fields came together. And further progress was made.
Can you tell me a little bit, sort of to put this in perspective for our readers, were there many people looking for this receptor?
At the time, and I'm speaking now about the late 80s, around 1990, that was our group at the Netherlands Cancer Institute, and that was Gabor Tighe, then working in California in Milady's group, who worked on Xenopus oocyte and also had discovered that LPA has growth factor-like or hormone-like activities. And we both independently set out to identify the receptor at the time, or as we were both convinced that there must be one or more specific receptors. But I'm not aware of other researchers at the time that were after this LPA receptor.
Why was it important to find the receptor?
Because if you have a ligand, an hormone-like substance that does many things to cells, then it must be mediated by a receptor, and the receptor is the triggering device, so to speak, that sets in motion the whole cascade. And having this receptor that means that you have the gene and the cDNA, and then you can look for family members, you can look for expression patterns, you can look for mutations, etc. So having the receptor these days is important, and also for the ultimate proof, of course, that your ligand acts through a specific receptor.
So why was it so difficult to clone these receptors? Why you had one that you thought was a candidate. Why was it so difficult to actually get it cloned?
Well, at the time, when you wanted to clone a receptor, you could follow two approaches. One approach was to purify the protein, but then you needed a lot of protein, membrane protein, then to sequence, to determine the amino acid sequence, and then go back to libraries and to find the gene that encodes the protein. There was another approach that is that you express the cDNA library in Xenopus oocytes and do a so-called expression cloning and then look for a search for a cDNA that mediates your response. But that those techniques at the time were really very difficult. Mm-hmm. And at the time, of course, the genome wasn't completely sequenced. So
right.
That was looking for a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
And quite difficult because we did not succeed in getting enough protein to microsequence it.
So how did the field react to Chun's finding?
It was an important finding. There was some, as he points out in his paper, perhaps some skepticism in the beginning. But soon thereafter, the results were confirmed, and that was an important time. Yes, in this paper, he's talking about a neurobiology field. We are not neurobiologists ourselves, so I can imagine that the neurobiologists were a little bit skeptical. But this was not true, I must say, in the growth factor field, where people accepted the idea quite rapidly. Also, because we found that LPA, lysophosphatidic acid, is a normal constituent of serum and that it's produced after platelet activation, so that it has all the features, all the hallmarks of a wound healing hormone, and showing that serum has a lot of bioactive LPA in it was, in my view, another important point to accept people in the growth factor field, to let people in the growth factor field accept that it is a bona fide ligand and not just an artificial ligand.
Right. So what did finding this receptor do for the field of lipidology?
Well, it was an important addition to a list of other lipid receptors because, as you may know, other lipids like platelet-activating factor and prostaglandins also bind to their receptors. So there was precedent for the concept for lipids binding to a specific receptor. In that sense, LPA binding to a receptor was not a completely new paradigm, so to speak. There were other examples of lipids binding to receptors, right? And the same holds true for that other lipid, singlet-in-1 phosphate, that is closely related to LPA structure.
So tell me a little bit about your research. How is your lab adding to the whole lysophospholipid story?
So we have, in the last decade, we have mainly focused on unraveling the downstream signaling events, the different G-protein signaling events and the small GTPases that are involved, ranging from cell proliferation, migration, and the neurite retraction response that Gerald described in his paper. And in addition to that, we have been busy to examine how LPA is produced in the extracellular environment. And the recent development in the field is that it's now quite well understood how LPA is produced. It is produced outside the cell by a phospholipase D, which is named autotaxin. And we have recently published, and also a Japanese group has published, that when you knock out the gene encoding this enzyme that produces LPA, then the mice die because of severe vascular defects during embryogenesis. Mm. So this strongly suggests that LPA production and LPA signaling has also a very important key role in vascular development, and that was a somewhat unexpected finding, actually, that is not quite well understood at the moment, but we are working on that to find out why LPA production is so important during embryonic development.
Can you talk a little bit about how the LPA is produced outside of the cells?
Yeah, LPA is produced from other phospholipids, that are normally present in the blood and in the circulation. Uh-huh. What is the actual trigger to set in motion the whole cascade that produces LPA is not quite well understood, because the enzyme that produces LPA has still a lot of mysteries. There are interesting domains and protein interaction domains that we still don't understand what they are doing. So a lot has to be learned here still. But fact is that this enzyme apparently is extremely important in development, but also in cancer, because in many cancer patients, we and other people find overexpression of this LPA-producing enzyme in different tissues, but also in the circulation. Mm. So the field, on the one hand, moves along unraveling signaling events and how receptors play a role in development. And at the same time, people, including ourselves, we are looking at how LPA is produced and what the properties of the LPA-producing enzymes are.
Right. Very interesting.
Right.
Yeah. What do you think will be the sort of big story for LPA? What do you think will be,
Well, that's difficult. That's difficult to predict, of course.
Sure.
It's always difficult
sure.
to make predictions in science. Well, we have learned already a lot from the knockout studies, the LPA receptor knockout studies that Gerald Chun has done and is still doing, and also from the autotaxin knockout studies that points to an important role in angiogenesis and vasculogenesis, and at the same time also in brain development. So I think those are the two areas, brain development or brain functioning, and angiogenesis, where a lot will be discovered in the near future. And talking about angiogenesis, I also would like to imply tumor angiogenesis, because as you know, tumor cells often rely on new blood vessel formation for their outgrowth. And and the idea is that also autotaxin and LPA play an important role here. That remains to be tested.
That was Wouter Molinar of the Netherlands Cancer Institute speaking with Associate Editor Adita Zielinska. You can read more about the lysophospholipid discoveries in the current issue of The Scientist and online at thescientist.com. You can also find blogs from our editors, daily news stories, and where in the country scientists earn the most money, as reported in our annual salary report. That's all for our podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco's cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.